This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Stay tuned for scenes from next week's Galaxy Quest.
Never give up. Never surrender.
He will save us.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the 99 Star Trek love letter slash piss take Galaxy Quest. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then go into the science, including octopus culture, convergent evolution, primate violence, and then we'll end with a look at different forms of satire. As always, the show's broke up into a few different segments. There's time codes below, so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. If you want to know whether that bar fight you got into on Saturday is just part of your DNA, you can skip ahead to primate violence. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Messes alongside Adam Hasek, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Right, shaping up my vocal cords. I haven't done an accent in a while, but this movie kind of calls for it. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soon. And So after hearing recordings of Dave on the podcast, a group of aliens mistook him for a real veterinarian and abducted him to take a look at their alien versions of cats and dogs, not realizing he's merely a podcast veterinarian and playing a role.
Imagine thinking Dave was a real vet.
Yeah.
Hopefully he made the trip and is not inside out.
And exploded.
News. Does everyone have news?
I have some news.
This isn't so much global environmental news as it is a cool paper that I saw that came out. Dolphins are prone to skin conditions such as yeast, bacterial, and viral pox infections, which seem to be exacerbated by climate change. But a new study published suggests that bottlenose dolphins may be self-medicating their skin ailments with the help of some corals, adding to growing research on their previously unexplored medicinal properties. So studying bottlenose dolphins in the Red Sea, researchers observed that the dolphins often queued up nose to tail to rub themselves against corals as soon as they woke up and right before they went to sleep, as if they were showering for the day. The team also noticed that dolphins returned to the same coral species and appeared to be meticulous in choosing which parts of their body to rub. They ran lab tests on about 48 different samples of corals, sponges, and coral mucus chosen by the dolphins, and the result revealed at least 17 different bioactive metabolites with antibacterial, antioxidant, and estrogen-like hormonal properties, all of which could be useful in skin treatments.
Nice. Are you telling me the corals are making the dolphins gay?
I mean, dolphins do like fish sticks, so.
I am surprised that a dolphin would ever queue up for anything, knowing how violent, predatory, problematic, and sexually deviant dolphins are as a species. As a group, there's many species.
The quote from one of the researchers saying, like, they would just, you know, they obviously dove to see them, and they said that they just patiently would, like, wait in line for these corals.
That's very British. Mm-hmm. British dolphins, yeah.
Don't jump the queue.
A one-hit wonder cast of actors from a decade-old sci-fi show struggle to adjust to their fading stardoms. Suddenly, they find themselves following their unqualified, impetuous, egotistical, and questionably charismatic leader, whom they all despise, into space to save an alien race they've never met from an intergalactic hopper from a bug's life. The questionable leader proceeds to blunder around for self-aggrandizement and ego-stroking, endangering the lives of his fellow actors, said aliens, and causing massive amounts of physical and monetary damage to their ship and port station, and further aggravating the war between Hopper to a deadly degree, with, of course, no personal consequence. After some horrific torture of an innocent alien friend, and the slow suffocation of the rest of the race, the John Wayne of space realizes absolutely nothing, and sees the thing through till the end at the cost of anyone's life, because once you've whipped your dick onto the star deck, you can't put it back in your pants. You've got to just keep fucking whipping it around, hitting everyone in the face with it. Fortunately, by Grabthaw's hammer and the power of the theater, the crew and the competent aliens manage to tap into their own worth and stop the mutated grasshopper from his genocidal plot. As with most egomaniacs, the fearless leader basks in the glory of saving the day whilst using the bodies and backs of the people that did it for him as the world's stage.
You know, with a summary like that, it really makes me realize that Tim Allen's character really is...
William Shatner?
Not just William Shatner, but they come to him because they think he's the savior. He's not qualified for it at all. He somehow blunders into it, to use some language from Libby's summary. Not really his fault it gets solved, but of course takes all the credit. Yeah, he's just white people. White men, specifically.
I just like that he keeps going because he wants to. He's like, no, I know y'all are scared, but like, I want to be the hero!
Yeah. I mean, I just like Tony Shalhoub, just like, yeah, whatever, we're in space. We're going this way? Yeah. Cool. I'm gonna go fuck this alien real quick.
What do we like about this movie?
There are so many things that I love about this movie. It's been one of my all-time favorites since I saw it in theaters. The cast, the writing, and year after year, it holds up. I've easily seen it about 20 times, and every time I watch it, it's fucking funny. But two words. Do I? This movie is where I first developed my massive crush on Sam Rockwell. Sigourney Weaver is undoubtedly a babe, but she's not the only one whose suit becomes further unzipped as the movie progresses, and I'm not mad about it. Shameless objectification here. It's also like where I developed my love for him as an actor, and he just continues to be a powerhouse of talent in like everything that he does, and this movie is no exception.
Even just that little, the little wink and the finger guns he gives to the camera in the end. Yeah. My God. Yeah, that's his audition tape for Justin Hammer right there.
Yeah. This movie was a movie that I have not seen since I was a child. I remember, I don't know if my parents rented the wrong movie, or maybe I'm just conflating in young Adam's memory of this and Lost in Space getting really mixed up in my head of thinking, is, you know, around the same time. And I didn't really get it. I was way too young for most of the humor. I couldn't appreciate a lot of what was going on. But watching this again with fresh eyes as a mature adult, it's a delight.
Mature.
So many wonderful performances. Give every one of those Thuramians a goddamn Oscar, because completely made that movie. It's just one of those things where it doesn't matter how good or bad a movie is. If there is an actor, or in this case, an entire group of actors that are just going balls to the wall 150% the entire time, it will elevate your art all the way and bring everyone else up with them.
I always forget that Rainn Wilson is in this movie. Like,
yeah. I was just going to say, debut. Yeah. I was just staring at him, like, you know, to every scene he's in. I'm like, is that Dwight Schrute? Is it him? Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Look at him. Of course he's an alien disguised as a human.
To bounce off what Adam said, the Thermians absolutely kill it. Especially Enrico Colantoni, Mathazar? Yeah. It just
Mathazar.
Incredible in every scene. Like, he even though he's acting so ridiculously and the words are just so over the top, when that heartbreaking scene where Tim Allen explains what an actor is and he's just like, but why?
Like,
it's really emotional.
It's heartbreaking.
This is an amazing parody, but there's no like spite or cynicism in it. Like I said, cynicism in it. It manages to be like a love letter at the same time as a total send up. It's just really nice, you know? And I love how much the Sigourney Weaver's like objectification is parodied in this. And then in Star Trek Into Darkness, like they didn't learn from that at all. Like the infamous scene with Alice Eve just with her top off for no fucking reason. Like they made fun of that 10 years beforehand. When did Into Darkness come out? 2009, 2010, something?
No, 2009 was the reboot.
Yeah, so 13 years later, after it being successfully pastiched so well, and they didn't even think, oh, should we be doing this? I mean, we were joking about how it's bad 13 years ago. Fucking hell. Yeah.
No, shit.
I really enjoyed that, yeah. And of course, yeah, the cast is just amazing.
Everyone does such a great job. Yeah. Can't really single anyone out. They're just fantastic. Is there anything you dislike, Libby?
poor, false Greg Knack. as I've said, I've seen this movie a lot, and every time I watch it, I feel so bad for the little Inside Out exploding bipedal pig lizard. Like, he just didn't deserve that fate.
Yeah.
I think it did a lot of things for its time, and I'm definitely not discounting that, as we just, Sam just mentioned. I do wish the female nerds were represented better. It's boys who save the day, you know, like Justin Long's and his crew. And the only real female nerds or nerd that they show, the one that has speaking lines, is asks really insipidly about like the romance of Captain Taggart and Sigourney Weaver's character.
Yeah.
And then the other gaggle of girls are just like swooning over Tim Allen, which, give me a break, no one would. and I was
everyone's mom would.
And yeah, I was a nerd growing up, and yes, like I did enjoy some of the romance, but there's nothing wrong with that. But of the shows and comics I read, I certainly cared about a lot of other things and can tell you painstaking details of that world or franchise, just as like Justin Long's character did. And I feel like they really misrepresented the female nerds in this movie.
This isn't so much a criticism, but at times I think this just straight up turns into what it's parodying. I think it goes from being a really funny send-up to just a straight-up Star Trek episode and then back at times, which, again, I don't know if it's a criticism. And look, like I said, this isn't a cynical, hateful piss take of anything, so it's fine. And the other thing is, I didn't find it that funny. Like, there was no point at which I was, like, really laughing out loud. I was just kind of smiling pleasantly for the whole thing. So, yeah, I don't know. Again, these are very weak criticisms, but it's all I could really come up with.
I'm going to piggyback off the second half of that comment there, because much like Sam, I think that it's a really good movie. The performances are solid. It is very funny, but it's not, to me anyway, laugh out loud funny. It's that kind of funny where you type LOL in the text, but you're really just kind of exhaling hard through your nose. I thought that was funny, but I'm not going to laugh about it. And
I think in defense of that, though, is that is because of the PG rating that they tried to give it. Because from my understanding of reading some of the trivia, they were doing a little bit more like adult, like funnier humor, but they took it out to give it a PG rating. So I think that's where it's like kind of more like family friendly fun.
Yeah. In relation to what Adam was saying, I have two things that direct very connectly to it. One is that, yeah, my kid also watched this with me yesterday. He's 9 years old, and yeah, he didn't understand what was going on. He didn't find it very funny at all. He went off and played Fortnite halfway through. And the other thing is that, yeah, I totally what you mean about the Lost in Space thing. Like, I could have sworn those little monkey aliens were part of Lost in Space and not this.
Same.
And the big Spider-Man. Yeah, the big Spider-Man, though, is Gary Oldman in Lost in Space. I could have I was waiting for him to show up in this one and be like the thing he fights after the pigman's gone. But no, that's Lost in Space. Now, the two movies that I watched a lot as a kid. I really enjoyed the nostalgia trip here, too.
Yeah, they reference a lot.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Okay, so my trivia is that in 2013, with 12 total actual Star Trek films in post-production, Galaxy Quest was actually voted 7th best Star Trek film of all time by fans.
Which is wonderful. And from my limited understanding of the Star Trek movies, very believable and understandable. Mm-hmm. I think my first trivium is going to be a sad, but my next one will be happier. So the rather heart-wrenching scene of Tim Allen's character in the bathroom, just hearing the nerds rag on him and saying like his crewmates, his fellow cast members hate him. The fans think he's a joke. He's washed up. He's really sad. That is inspired by an incident that actually happened to William Shatner in the exact same way at a con or at an appearance in 1986, where he was in the bathroom and heard fans say the exact same thing about him.
Continuing with the sad theme, there was actually talk of making a Galaxy Quest sequel. I assume inspired by the fact that Star Trek had rebooted as well. Started around 2014, but sadly, a lot of the plot centered around Alexander Dane and the Jason Nesmith characters. And Alexander Dane, of course, was played by Alan Rickman, who passed away in 2016. And so the film kind of just fizzled out and never happened.
I feel like related to that, I don't know if this is something I heard about this potential sequel, or if this is just a false memory from my childhood of not knowing what movie this actually was. I could have sworn, maybe this is like a, what's the alternate dimension effect, like Berenstein Bears, what's that called?
Mandela Effect.
I could have sworn there was a version of this movie where Alexander Dane, Alan Rickman's character was actually in love with Tim Allen's character, and that's why there was so much jealousy and anger towards him, because there was like real genuine affection. I might be thinking of a different movie.
Yeah, Lost in Space.
Maybe. It could have been. My happier trivium is that, so the lead Thermion, Enrico Colantoni, everyone's favorite weird alien, he came into the audition doing that voice as a choice. He wasn't told to. He just thought, you know, if I'm going to play an alien, I'm going to be a fucking alien. Yeah. And the casting director loved it so much, she broke protocol, took his audition tape, and showed it to all the other Thermians and said, this is how you need to sound. Right. So his, like, choice on that day defined an entire alien species.
I would have loved it if they finished the audition and said, amazing, we love the voice you're doing. And he just goes, what voice are you talking about?
It's one of those things where it's definitely different enough where you know it's an alien, especially if you know anything about other languages, but also, is he Finnish? Maybe?
Yes! Yes! Oh my god, right up from the north, Lapland and that sort of stuff.
Especially the Thermian who says, and he exploded. He looks Finnish, so these aliens are probably mostly Finnish.
Yeah, if he had a blonde wig on.
So similar to Adam's bit about William Shatner, Gwen DeMarco, who's played by Sigourney Weaver, laments that her TV Guide interview was just, quote, six paragraphs of my boobs and how they fit into my suit. This actually happened to actor Jeri Ryan, who played Seven of Nine on Star Trek Voyager in 1995.
I mean, there seems to be just a lot of stuff that is taken directly from the Star Trek cast experience in real life here.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So Sam Rockwell, whose performance we've already waxed lyrical about, he based his whole performance here on Bill Paxton's character in Aliens, the constantly freaking out.
Game over, man!
Yeah, exactly. He's just like, anything that he thought Bill Paxton's character would have done, he did it.
I've seen this movie so much, and I've noticed it before, and I pointed it out to Adam, because I just always find it really funny, but despite Guy Fleegman, as we know, Sam Rockwell's character, persistent express fears about his character, crewman number six, being expendable and immediately dying, he's actually the only crew member not to be shot and killed by Saris during the deadly ambush in the film's climax.
Oh, nice.
I thought that was such like a cute, funny Easter egg. Yeah, like if you're paying attention, you're like, hey, he makes it.
Yeah.
He's the plucky comic relief.
I'm not even supposed to be here. I'm just crewman number six. I'm expendable. I'm the guy in the episode who dies to prove the situation is serious.
So, before we get stuck into the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hasik Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit the website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. If you check the episode description or the website, you'll find the server address there. If you want to read Libby's work, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com, and you can read a squelching squiggles worth of short stories. And if you want to hear more about the less movie-related, more ecology-based science that Adam, myself, and a massive team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. As well as that, if you've got the time, we would really appreciate if you could log onto your podcast app and give us a rating, preferably 5 stars. It really helps the pod. And if you've got any movies that you'd like us to cover, please get in touch, let us know. We're always looking for suggestions from fans.
Yes, please.
We have talked a lot about octoplunks or octopodes or octopuses recently, but we have not talked about them in terms of being group animals, which they are seen to be in this one. So we have what I guess is supposed to be a species, the Thermians, that are based on octopids that have come out of the ocean and, you know, colonized land and then the stars.
Which is terrifying when you think about it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, octopus are very, very solitary animals, generally. But there are some areas where they're kind of forced to live together, or they just happen to. Two of these are, like, really big communities in Jervis Bay in Australia. And researchers have given these names, these communities fantastic names.
They really have.
One is called Octopolis. The other one is called Octlantis.
Which is lovely, because science usually gives the most boring names. I mean, I can look no further than my own research during my PhD of going out to Pond 4, Pond 35, Pond 17, and Pond 3.
In any case, you might think that when octopus group together, because they're such intelligent animals and they do have the capability to feel emotion and pain, you might think that would make them more empathetic towards each other. But as we've also said before on this podcast, more intelligence just generally gives animals more of a capacity to be a total fuckwit.
It really does.
Yeah, male octopuses form dominance hierarchies really quickly by bullying smaller, more submissive octopuses. This is from a fantastic article by Professor Kristen Andrews in The Conversation from a while ago. She basically talks about that in Octopolis, they've observed male octopuses throwing scallop shells to defend their den. The mantle up display, which basically involves the octopus's mantle, which is what I guess we would kind of think about as the majority of their body, if we translate
it. Kind of the big balloony head.
Yeah. Just sticks that right up into the air and then just, yeah, like basically punching other octopuses and throwing shit at them constantly.
They're also known to punch fish just because they can, because why the fuck not would you not bully an innocent creature?
Is that the octopus's term for manning up? Is mantling up?
Mantling up, yes.
Probably.
Submissive octopuses will signal compliance with like light colors, because, of course, octopus can change their texture and their colors.
It's really fucking cool.
It is. It's amazing. Like, you see, you hear about things blending in with their environment, but this is just kind of them becoming their environment, like mimicking their environment's texture and shape and all that sort of stuff. It's amazing.
Libby and I actually went scuba diving last week, and we were fortunate enough to be able to see an octopus. And not only did it change color, not only did it change texture, but we almost saw it punch a fish for no other reason than it could.
I think it tried, but it was the tentacle that it was like missing. So
it got real close. Yeah. It was like,
yeah, it got real close.
I should make it clear that we say octopuses are amazing creatures, and you may think they're invincible lords of the sea, but they also have a lifespan of like 1 year. So, you know, there's downsides.
And a lot of them are very small and very, very picked upon by larger predators. Or weird South Africans who abandon their family to hang out with an octopus.
Oh, God. so weird. Yeah. but yeah, I mean, the octopus fights, as always, it's for the same stuff as usual. It's for females and housing.
This octopus rent is too damn high.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's cost me 20 scallops.
And I should say, the article, basically, the whole point of this article by Professor Andrews is why you shouldn't eat octopus. Because they were basically thinking of starting octopus farms earlier this year in certain parts of the world.
I saw that.
Yeah, we've said it before. Don't eat octopus. They're smarter than a 2-year-old child. Like, that's, you know, not something you should be eating. Yeah, if you put octopuses together, not only are you then killing intelligent creatures, but you are forcing them to form a culture and a community. Because if you put individuals together of a cultured species, then you are going to form hierarchies, cultures, systems, that sort of thing. I think that makes it worse.
That's one of the bad things about chicken farming, because chickens have social groups of hierarchies and dominants and submissives, and they can only recognize somewhere around, I think it's 17 or 13, maybe Libby knows the actual number, but when you put these chickens in these massive, unfortunately disgusting factory farms, it just makes them have nothing but stress, because they cannot recognize members, because there's way too many chickens for them to keep track of, in addition to all the stress they're already going through.
As we've seen in the documentary featuring Mel Gibson, Chicken Run.
Yes.
Yeah. But lastly, yeah, so if you've, I mean, we don't know, this is an extraterrestrial species, but who knows what would happen if you forced octopus to live together for millions of years? You know, what sort of behavioral and, you know, cultural evolution we'd see amongst them? And hey, you know, here's a rough approximation, which I think is a really cool aspect of this film.
They
would all talk like this the whole time.
Yeah. Watch the historical documents.
Now I can think of as like an Ewok on the moon of Yavin 4 situation, where you're going scuba diving, enjoying your time at the coral reef, and there's just a troop of octopi just come over the reef with their little spears in hand, just getting ready to take you down together.
Throw some scallop shells at you.
And they think they're doing real damage, but it's just like the most harmless thing you've ever felt. Like, ow, stop.
Imagine if the historical documents, as opposed to Galaxy Quest, had been My Octopus Teacher.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
We have come for cuddles.
Yeah.
So, Galaxy Quest poses, or at least falls victim to the trope of many different sci-fis tend to, especially when we look at intergalactic or spacefaring races. They all look like people in suits, and while there is a practical reason for this, they are all people in suits. The more interesting way to look at this, I think, is from the term, from the lens of evolutionary history. So, this is either a world where everybody's played by things in suits, which we're going to say it's not because this is a real world of this movie, or there is some kind of correlation between intelligence, sapience, sentience, and reaching the level of intergalactic culture and the hominid form. By hominid, I mean the type of body that humans have. Upright, bipedal, bilateral symmetry, a shoulder joint. And I think this works because at least on our planet, you tend to see a lot of the hominid species are, relative to many other animals, quite intelligent. Especially us. I would say that we are the smartest ones on the planet, and because we said we are, so we are, because we made the system. But Sam raises an interesting point with the Thermians of, if they're going to be an octopode species, we also have very intelligent octopode species on our planet. So I'm going to posit that there is a common theme of convergent evolution between sapience and or intelligence, and either the hominid body plan or the mollusk, and specifically cephalopod body plan, squid, octopus, cuttlefish, any of those.
Cuttlefish.
Womp.
Convergent evolution is where you have two or more very different species and or lineages displaying very similar traits because they've evolved to the same, quote, endpoint. If you look at a shark and a dolphin, they're both well adapted to move through water. They both have fins on the side of their body. They both have a dorsal fin. They both have the caudal fin is the one underneath their belly. This isn't because, all life on Earth shares a common ancestor way, 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 way back in the day. That's why we're all fish, including James McAvoy. But
did you say James McElroy?
I didn't, but I wish I did.
And on top of that, the dolphin and the shark aren't the only non-related species to evolve that body plan. We had, mosasaurs and ichthyosaurs as well, marine reptiles who almost look exactly the same.
And this isn't because they're sharing a recent common ancestor. It's because they're adapting to the same selection pressure. In this case, living an aquatic or marine lifestyle. When you have many different organisms facing that same pressure, it shapes them into the same shape, even though they are very, very differently related. So I'm going to posit that the humans, the whatever Saren's race is, those creepy little goblin noseless fucks on the desert planet, they're all sharing a certain level of convergent evolution to have this hominid body plan and a degree of intelligence, some more than others. And then also, on that same note, we have the Thermians, which have the cephalopod body plan, a very, very intelligent species. They made a fucking intergalactic spaceship that can go well beyond the speed of light, which is theoretically impossible, but science fiction, so who gives a fuck? But I think I wanted all this to bring this back to a somewhat parallel but different thing with evolutionary history in homologous evolution. This is when you have a species with a recent common ancestor have similar structures, even if they look very different. So a good example of this is our hand. Our hand is very similar to the hand of other primates because we share very recent common ancestors. But if you look at our hand and compare it to other mammals, such as a bat, we have the same bones in the same places. They're just shaped differently. This is because of that sharing of a recent common ancestor. So, on a suggestion from Levy when we were watching this movie, I think the creepy fin-eared, noseless fucks on the desert planet may either be a relative of or potentially a juvenile form of Saren's race. And if they are closely related and potentially even the same species, that those ear fins they have, which science fiction loves to put on a quote aquatic species despite it making no sense, could be useful as a form of signal or threat display, which is something that Saren, his species, at least himself, also does, albeit on a different part of his body.
Yeah, those kind of back spines that look a little bit like a lionfish or something like that. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think about. I'll just chuck this bit in here, because then we can do it for like 2 minutes and then move on. It's interesting to think as to, because I mean, you have very different levels of apparent sentience and intelligence between those two species. So it's interesting to think, like, would those spines still be around? Like, would they still serve that purpose when you have developed the capability for speech and threats and intimidation?
Think about your comment at the beginning of this episode with having a bar fight or, you know, glassing somebody at the pub. These types of obnoxious, physically intimidating threat displays are something that a lot of other primates do that are not on our same level of intelligence.
Yeah.
And we're still have not changed a bit.
Nope.
Did you want to fight?
Yes, please. I would like to have a little bit of a fight.
Sure.
Yeah.
Speaking about primate violence, one of my favorite, but maybe one of the scenes that everybody knew was coming in the film, was when the small Teletubbies from hell rip apart their compatriot. Now, the impression is given that they're tearing into him because he's weak and they cannot tolerate weakness, which does happen in the animal world. And Adam and I actually did a particularly ill-fated experiment back when we were master students about how ants will take dying or injured ants and just remove them. And just get them the hell away from the nest entrance. Yeah, so they don't spread disease, parasites, or anything like that. But I maintain that this primate, because I'm going to refer to it as a primate from now on, had been kind of already injured by the other members of the group who just had taken a dislike to him for some reason. Because, I mean, we know this happens all the time with gorillas. Chimps especially, not so much bonobos, but chimps, 100%. They will just, you know, take a dislike to someone in the troop, and that one will go missing. Yeah, you're done. So I maintain that this one had previously been injured by the group and had just survived, and they were like, oh, this guy's back again. Let's just wait till he's not watching, and then we can finish him off.
Maybe that's why they didn't like him, because he was not the brightest tool in the box. He just keeps coming back.
Just got on the bad side of somebody, yeah. But yeah, this is totally in line with primates. So, mammals in general are not the most violent murderous species, but it does happen. There was a fantastic study about 6 years ago, I think it was, by Jose Maria Gomez from the University of Granada. And it was covered in a fantastic article by one of my favorite science writers, a man named Ed Yong, who, incredible science writer, but one of my heroes in this sort of thing. He just does such good articles. He weaves such good science and stories into them. He's covered the COVID pandemic really well for the past 2 years. So if you ever want to like take a dip into science journalism, go and read Ed Yong's stuff. But he covered Dr. Gomez's study really well. And it looked into violence in the mammal world between individuals of the same species. So, guessing trivia time, what do you think is the animal most likely, the mammal, I should say, most likely to be murdered by a member of its own species?
Are we including humans in this?
To take away the obvious guess, humans are not even in the top 30. In the top 30.
I didn't think it was humans.
Yeah. No, I just wasn't sure. Is it a skuid species, like a chipmunk or a squirrel?
No.
A vole.
Getting closer, but not so much.
A vole with a spiky helmet.
A vole with a grudge.
The top 10 is dominated a lot by lemurs and monkeys, but number one is actually the meerkat. Almost 20% of meerkat deaths are inflicted by other meerkats. Up in that top 30, you also have kind of more traditional inclusions on this sort of thing, like lions, grey wolves, pumas, big predators, that sort of thing. There's a lot of monkeys in there as well. But there's also a couple of things you might not expect. There's long-tailed marmots, like I said, the meerkat, sifakas as well, the ground squirrel, Californian ground squirrel, dharma gazelles as well, for some reason.
Interesting.
Damn.
And New Zealand sea lions, too. But a lot of these top 30, the thing is, though, a lot of this violence is adults killing kids. So, you know, like, as we've talked about before, a lion will move in after he's taken a pride over from a former male and murder all of that lion's offspring.
Polar bears. Yeah. Zebras. Can you imagine being a species like the meerkat that lives in a place where there are lions, jaguars, cheetahs, black mambas, who knows how many other venomous snakes and hyenas, fucking African wild dogs. And he thought, nah, let's kill each other more than they can kill us. Like, what the fuck are you thinking, Timon? Come on.
That's why they spell meerkat with a K, because a K stands for killer.
But primates are typically very violent. So, like I said, that's the reason I'm theorizing that this thing was injured, because it had been beaten up before. Gomez used the similarities to predict how violent any given mammal should be, and whether it meets, exceeds, or defies those expectations. And he said that humans do all three. So we exceed expectations because we are far more violent than normal mammals. We meet the expectations because we are about as violent as normal primates. And we defy those expectations because we are a lot less violent than we used to be. So in the Paleolithic times, they think human-on-human violence was much higher, which makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And that even in medieval times, human violence was much, much higher. And as, you know, rule of law took over and took hold in a lot of countries, that violence has gone down. So despite the fact that we are still, of course, incredibly violent creatures, we have managed to curb our tendencies somewhat through structured societies. The behavior that we see here is totally on brand for a species of primate anywhere. So, yeah. I think this is by far the most realistic part of this movie. Just that little guy getting absolutely torn to pieces. And yeah, Sam Rockwell saw it all coming.
So we've talked before in a previous episode a little bit about the difference between satire and parodies, homages, that kind of thing. But I wanted to focus in on satire for some deeper probing, if you will, alien reference. Because Galaxy Quest is a beautiful example of satire. So satire is a way to bring attention to something without directly implying your meaning. Satirical writing is humorous and boisterous and often, but not always, draws attention to problems within government or society. But did you know that satire within itself as a topic has three different types?
No.
So the first type is called Horatian. Horatian satire is comedic and offers light social... It offers light social commentary. It is meant to poke fun at a person or situation in an entertaining way. Horatian satire carries the same name of Roman satirist Horace, who used this form of satire in his poetry around 35 BC. This type of satirical writing does not seek to draw attention to societal problems or show social commentary necessarily. It just simply wants to entertain the audience with funny, lighthearted stories and making light of human folly by satirizing features of humanity that people can easily recognize and see in themselves. So some examples of this in writing are Gulliver's Travels, written in the 18th century by Jonathan Swift. And his work is kind of a spoof of travelogues that were common at that time. So Pride and Prejudice is also Horatian. Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Huh.
Some newer examples include The Onion.
Yeah.
The satirical website that puts forth fake news stories. That's Horatian satire. The Colbert Report is also Horatian. So he uses his platform to sort of poke fun in a very lighthearted way without making too much of a political statement. But we'll get into the next topic, because some of these can blend, which is Juvenalian.
Wait, hang on. You said Colbert does not make too much of a political statement?
So it's a blend. Juvenalian is the next type. And it is more a satire that's used to attack political or religious leaders. But that type of satire isn't necessarily meant to be funny or like entertain in the same way. So the Colbert Report is Horatian in the sense that, yes, it does do attack politics and religion and things like that. But it's all meant in a very lighthearted like way to entertain people. Okay. Like, it's very tongue-in-cheek.
So it sounds like that the Discworld books and a lot of Terry Pratchett's work would fall into Horatian as well. Like, have you guys read Good Omens? Or seen the TV show? Yeah, so that would be Horatian, right?
I'm not sure, because I've only seen Good Omens, the show, so I'm not sure if I can make a qualified assessment without having read it.
To be fair, it is one of, like, the Good Omens show is one of the most pure adaptations of book to TV show I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, so the next type would be Juvenalian. So Juvenalian satire is dark rather than comedic. It's meant to speak truth to power and is often used to attack political or religious leaders. It gets its name from Roman satirist Juvenal, who wrote in the 1st century BC. Most political cartoons are this type of satire. So these cartoons, like in the newspaper and things like that, these cartoons poke fun at political leaders and institutions without trying to really make people laugh. It's just more of a juxtaposition to show contrasting ideas or theme. Okay. So famous examples of this type of satire are George Orwell's Animal Farm. Obviously, its intended target is communism in the Stalin-era Soviet Union, but it's also like an allegorical satire that has a much deeper political meaning. Like I said before, some can blend. So Gulliver's Travels, as I mentioned, was an example of Horatian. It's also an example of Juvenalian. So this book tackles the hypocrisy both found in politics and religion. So example of mixing different forms of satire to get your point across as an author. Modest Proposal, also by Jonathan Swift. And then a modern day example of juvenile satire is the television show South Park.
Okay.
So that juxtaposes satire with crude humor as it tackles current political topics. So you get the sense too, like, yes, South Park is funny, but it's much more dark than, say, the Colbert Report.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. Just enough for you. Third and final type is called, I might be mispronouncing this, but I'm going to pronounce it the way that I read it, Manippean. Manippean satire casts moral judgment on a particular belief, such as homophobia or racism. It can be comic and light, much like Horatian satire, although it can be as stinging as Juvenalian satire. Manippean satire focuses on philosophies and people's character flaws. It's similar to Horatian, where it pokes fun at humans and their beliefs, but it's much more negative and judgmental and less about making people laugh. This form of satire gets its name from the Greek philosopher Menippus, who wrote in the 3rd century BC. And though his works have been lost, his ideas have found their way into modern fiction. So many Menippean satire works focus on fantasy or science fiction as a way to showcase satirical ideas. So famous examples of this are Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. You know, that novel pokes fun at upper-class intellectualism, but does it with a distinct sense of humor. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, and then a modern day example of Manippean satire is Saturday Night Live. So,
Okay. You mentioned that Pride and Prejudice is a Horatian satire.
Mm-hmm.
What would Pride and Prejudice and Zombies be?
I would say still Horatian.
Okay. Yeah, because it is kind of lovingly just making people laugh at the satire.
And still poking fun at zombie movies as well.
Now, do you have a thought on or a definitive answer on what Galaxy Quest is?
I would say it's Horatian,
for sure. That was my guess, but I'm not a writer.
It's not, like, dark at all. It's done really kind of lovingly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you can enjoy this movie if you've never seen any of Star Trek before?
Yes. I think that there's enough representation of sci-fi in pop culture that you can understand the references without having seen Star Trek or those types of shows.
As evidenced by the fact that I never watched Star Trek and still never have watched anything beyond the new three movies, which I really like, by the way. More so, I would say, than the new three Star Wars movies.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think this is a movie that... I kind of recognized this as I went through it today. I was like, I really enjoy this, but I see how I could get more out of it if I did know a little bit more about Star Trek and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's all kinds of little nods, winks, you know, little shoulder bumps, like, oh yeah, that's this and that's that, and this is what that's coming from. But like you say, beyond the three more recent Star Trek movies and a handful of Next Generation episodes, I have next to no knowledge of Star Trek, and I still appreciate the fuck out of this.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the praises that it's consistently received, is that even though it is a satire and, you know, like a love letter, like you were saying, Sam, earlier, it is also a standalone movie. You know, it has the formula, it has the laughs, it has the cast and the writing to go with it, and you don't really need to know all of the references to understand this as the film, as a film that it is.
So, do we feel bad for any of the... they're all kind of sentient, so let's just say species? Monsters, I guess?
But the false Grignac is not sentient that we know.
That is true, yeah. And the rock monster I kind of feel bad to as well, just transported into a new atmosphere and then just gets shot out into space.
Into space.
Yeah. Obviously, the Thermians we feel bad for.
Oh, yeah. They've been getting genocided. That's awful.
And Finnish people in general, too. I mean...
Yeah, it's cold up there.
Sharing a border with Russia these days. My God, that's not fun.
I don't really feel anything for the fin-eared primates. They're just kind of there. They're violent.
The children.
The children.
Same way, I don't want to come face-to-face with a chimpanzee, but I don't have any particular empathy for them. We should stop knocking down the territory, of course, but...
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. These ones seem to be doing fine. Very little human interference. Would we recommend this movie?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Not to 9-year-olds, apparently, though.
Yeah, you need to be of a certain age to appreciate the humor of this movie.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Like I said, there's no, like, massive belly laughs here, but it's just nice, you know? I really like that bit when the ship just starts kind of drifting to the left and everyone's just kind of sitting there like, oh! Yeah. And Alan Rickman going dead set, like, serious, like, by Grandpa's hammer, you shall be avenged. And earlier in the movie where it's just like, oh, God, I hate my life. By Grandpa's hammer, what a savings.
What a savings.
Yeah.
I feel like there must have been a nod to that in the J.J. Abrams' first Star Trek, where I cannot remember the navigator's, the actor's name who plays the...
John Cho.
Where he has the handbrake on, basically, of the Enterprise, and Chris Pine is like, did you take the handbrake off? He's like, of course.
Yeah.
And takes it off, and they can actually start moving again.
So from my understanding, Abrams is like a massive Galaxy Quest fan, and he put several references in the Star Trek movies.
So next week we'll be coming back with the 80s Monster Fest in Critters, a movie that I've never seen but looks like an absolute riot. So watch it enjoy.
This is the Mockbuster of Gremlins?
It seems to be.
Don't know.
Or Mockbuster of the Langoliers, the Stephen King book and movie.
Oh, yeah.
Not entirely. I've never seen it either, so.
We'll solve it next week. And as we say here at the end of every episode... Never give up, never surrender. No, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Galaxy Quest.
You're just going to have to kill it.
Well, go for the mouth, the throat, his vulnerable spots.
It's a rock. It doesn't have any vulnerable spots.